Hello, and welcome to episode 18 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho, formerly incarcerated person, a freelance writer, an author, and a criminal justice reform advocate. This week, I'll be talking about the First Step Act, which recently passed committee in the U.S. House of Representatives, with my guests, Ames Groward, a senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice, Jessica Jackson Sloan, the co-founder with Van Jones of the organization Cut 50, and Jason Pye, the vice president of legislative strategy at FreedomWorks. Before we get to these interviews, a few announcements. First, as you might have noticed, during our last episode, Joel asked to take a sabbatical from the podcast. He is sorely missed, but I'm doing my best without him. Thanks to Joel for helping me get this podcast off the ground. Second, I took my first week off last week, and then some scheduling conflicts delayed the release of this episode. Apologies, I will do my best to get new episodes as expeditiously as possible. Finally, I just want to tease some really exciting episodes coming up, including an interview with some of the folks behind the Oscar-nominated documentary short, Knife Skills. And just a few days ago, I got confirmation from Bruce Western, the sociologist at Harvard, who confirmed that he will be doing an interview with me about his new book, Homeward, about reentry, which is very exciting to me. I'm kind of a nerd, so sociologists and criminologists of any note are, you know, kind of like my celebrities, I guess would put it. Okay, there'll also be some more surprises coming soon as well, but let's move on to our discussion of the First Step Act, or as it's technically known, the Formerly Incarcerated Reenter Society Transitioning Every Person Act, otherwise known as the First Step. Okay, as I mentioned, this bill recently passed out of the House Judiciary Committee on a 25-5 vote. The First Step Act is currently constructed does a number of things. It requires implementation of evidence-based recidivism reduction programming for federal prisoners. It allows eligible offenders, or, you know, I hate that word, eligible incarcerated people, to earn what we have always called good time credits, which would allow them to serve part of their sentence in home confinement, halfway houses, or in community supervision. And yes, I hate that word eligible in addition to the word offender, because that means the bill contains a lot of carve-outs. Anyone who listens to this podcast knows I really don't like carve-outs very much. We'll talk about that more when we get to the interviews. Okay, it also has some other very important provisions related to prisoner reentry into society, to the mentoring of prisoners in federal facilities and also after release, to creating opportunities for people to volunteer, to providing program and mentoring, and also to ensuring better treatment of women in federal facilities, which is very important. If you know anything about women's prisons, or you've heard some of our episodes that talked about that, there's a pretty unique need in women's facilities, and a lot needs to be done there. I keep mentioning the word federal because this bill is federal, which means it will only directly reach prisoners in federal facilities. I will include a link to the entire bill and most of the other support articles and things throughout the podcast for things we mention in the notes, which you can find at decarcerationnation.com or through your whatever app you're listening to. Now, in the current political environment at the federal level, since the election of Donald Trump, and especially since the appointment of Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, criminal justice reform has been considered more or less a dead issue. So what makes this bill different? Well, one very gigantic thing. First of all, the bill is moving, and there's a good reason for that. The bill is being shepherded by President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, whose father was also incarcerated at one point. This means it has a very good chance of being signed if it reaches the president's desk. In addition, the bill has created some controversy on the Hill because for many months prior to the introduction of the First Step Act, Senator Grassley has been moving a sentencing reform bill, which he and others believe can pass the Senate. But another complicating factor here is that Jeff Sessions really doesn't like sentencing reform, and so part of the delicate negotiations over that have caused that bill some problems in moving, and there isn't sentencing reform in the First Step Act. So the argument goes, if there's a way to get the Senate on board, the First Step Act has a pretty good chance of passage, or at least end up being signed, whereas the Grassley bill, while it might pass the Senate, might have a harder time becoming law. Now, how that'll play out, we still have yet to see, but that is one of the splits that's causing problems on this bill. And one thing to keep in mind when thinking about all this is that for any criminal justice reform bill to pass, there has to be a final version that both houses will vote for and that the president signs. Unless, of course, the president doesn't sign it, in other words, he vetoes it, he could table it too, but if he vetoes it and sends it back, then it would have to get a two-thirds majority, and that's very unlikely to happen in the current political environment. So more likely, it has to pass both houses in a particular form and be signed by the president. Okay, finally, this bill is also getting a lot of attention because there have been splits in both the left-leaning criminal justice reform community and the right-leaning criminal justice reform community. There are a lot of people who support the bill on both sides and some people who don't support the bill on both sides. So one of the things I'm trying to do with this episode is to speak to some of that, or to ask some of the experts about the splits and about the reasons they support or don't support the legislation. And luckily, I'm also including a member of a more conservative organization, FreedomWorks, who is going to talk to us about the what's happening on the right with this bill. So apologies again for the long introduction. This is a very complex policy environment, and the bill raises a lot of passion in both its supporters and detractors. So let's get to the interviews. Very excited to welcome my first guest, Ames Grauert, to discuss the First Step Act with me today. Mr. Grauert is a senior counsel with the Justice Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. The Brennan Center currently opposes passage of the First Step Act, so Ames seemed like the perfect person to ask about their opposition to the bill. Hello, Ames. How you doing?
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, so good to have you and finally get to talk to you after all this time.
Glad to be your Twitter friend.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So let's start with obviously the easiest question possible. What's your best case for why we should all join with the Brennan Center in opposing the First Step Act?
Yeah, for sure. I want to lead with just one note that, like, that this can look from the outside or even from the inside sometimes like a sort of high drama split between the different parts of the progressive coalition to end mass incarceration. I don't want people to come away thinking it is that. I have the utmost respect for everything Cut 50 does. Alex and I go back for as long as I've been in the field. I'm a big fan of his. So
if you feel any better, the first thing Alex said was, I really dig that guy.
So, all right. That's good. I was worried that, like, I'd lose someone who I consider to be a pretty good friend over this. So I'm glad to hear it's not the case.
No, not at all.
Well, yeah. So the simple answer is that we just don't view the First Step Act as a measurable step toward reducing mass incarceration. That's the long and the short of it. People will make the case saying, look, this would lead to 4,000 people going home immediately. But how they define home is really the rub of it. It could lead to 4,000 people, as many as 4,000 people going to home confinement or different types of pre-release custody. But those people would still be serving sentences under the Bureau of Prisons. They'd still be incarcerated in at least some sense of the word. And all of that is subject to how directives would be drafted by the Jeff Sessions Justice Department. And you'll forgive me if I don't have a lot of respect or trust for the Jeff Sessions Justice Department.
I think the one thing all the elements of our coalition would probably agree on is that we don't have a lot of faith in the Jeff Sessions Justice Department.
Exactly right. Yeah, and there was some news a while ago. I've not heard how this has continued to play out, but to Cut 50's credit, this bill got a lot better during the drafting process. The first time I saw something about it, Alex shared with me a draft that was kind of decent, but then the next draft he shared had been shot through with a bunch of poison pills placed there, it seems, by Jeff Sessions, provisions to, make sure it wouldn't pass, basically. So it seems like Sessions has opposed this from the start, and that gives me a lot of suspicion about how he would implement it. And he would have a non-trivial amount of power over the implementation of it.
Well, since we're kind of headed in that direction, it sounds like anyway. I mean, I think some people have argued that opposition to this bill is more about the politics of not giving Trump or the Sessions group a criminal justice victory than it is about good policy outcomes. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I don't. I do, and I disagree with that characterization. If President Trump presented us tomorrow with, a sentencing reform bill, I think we'd all We'd be very surprised for one, but but I think we'd be delighted in that. No one wants to, or no one's opposing real reform, however it comes to us. What I think this is instead is it's not the politics of it aren't about denying the president a win. Instead, I think the politics are people really want to see some proof that there's still a chance for anything to happen in a bipartisan way in Congress. So they're willing to accept whatever that looks like. Like they want a show of bipartisan unity, whether or not it's meaningful is beside the point. We're not big fans of shows of unity that don't actually accomplish anything. I think it's telling too that you don't really see the White House super excited about this bill. They released some principles for reform, like any reform bill has to include the following. The sort of thing that if they were really behind the bill, it would have been, you know, a big press conference with the president talking about it publicly on the, maybe not in the Rose Garden, but maybe he'd make a pretty big deal of it. Instead, I think those principles dropped at like 4 o'clock on a Thursday or a Friday with absolutely no fanfare. You had to Google around to find it. this is not something they're super excited about or proud of. So it's definitely not, we're not opposing this because we want to deny him a win. I question as to whether he even thinks this is a win.
Well, that's interesting. Most of the stuff that I've read seems to suggest that the First Step Act is a bill that can reach the president's desk and that the president, even if reluctantly, will probably sign, maybe because of the involvement of his son-in-law.
Right.
Do you have a reason to believe? I mean, one of the things you talked about earlier was kind of the notion that what does it mean to go home? And you also talked a little bit about the different, that this might not be everything we hope it will be. But do you have a reason to believe there's a better bill out there with a chance of reaching the president's desk and of becoming law? Or do you have some other play in mind?
Yeah, I for two things. So first, I think there's excuse me, just clear my throat a little. It's allergy season in New York.
I think everywhere it's allergy season.
Indeed. Yeah. I think there's no – I'm not – I could see a world where the president doesn't sign it. Like if the attorney general was trying to sabotage the bill mere weeks ago, I have no doubt that he's still trying to work some magic in the background. It may be that he ultimately won't prevail. It may be that he's been told, you know, sit down and take this one for the team. But there are a couple obstacles to this bill and they're not all in Congress. This is the one argument that resonates with me the most. And it's the one that, I've honestly gone back and forth with a few times. Like I'm reminded, one of my favorite books is this Robert Caro book that's basically a biography of Lyndon Johnson in five parts, four of which have been written.
Believe it or not, I've read the series. So
good man, that's such a good series.
It is.
So you know really what I'm you know what I'm talking about. So absolutely. Master of the Senate,
yep.
Is all about how Johnson took a pretty unimpressive civil rights bill just because he saw it as the way of breaking the logjam and filibuster in Congress. And that, like, should we look at this First Step Act as something similar? Like, not everything you want, but a way to get the ball rolling, a way to show real support for criminal justice reform in Congress. Should we just, you know, take it as a win and continue to advocate for change in the future? That is the thing that comes the closest to persuading me. And where it falls short is a couple things. For one, I think I'd be more interested if I could see what the second step to the First Step Act is. And I've not gotten a good answer to that. And I don't know what people think the second step would be and where it could come. Like if we'd been clued into a broad legislative strategy as to this is the first step, the second step will be an amendment to include sentencing reform in the Senate that will certainly pass. And then both bills will pass together. That would get me thinking, like that'd be the way to get us on board. But I haven't seen that strategy play out. And aside from that, I don't know if this is the same as that sort of 1957 logjam. Most of Congress, if you gave them a clear vote today, I think would vote for sentencing reform. So why should we pretend that they wouldn't? Why shouldn't we just give them a bill that they'd vote up and down on in favor? I realize the answer is there's majority leader politics. There's other congressional politics in the background. But, can't we cut through that with good advocacy? And last but not least, you know, even if we did think this was 1957 all over again, you know, the progressive left had a part to play there to make sure that the modest bill that passed then was as good as it could be. And I know Alex and the Cut 50 team have played that role admirably. But other progressive leaders had an equally valuable role to play there of saying, you know, this isn't enough. This is, if you think this is going to keep us quiet, you're dead wrong. We need to keep working on it, and we need to see what the second step is. And that's ultimately where I land. But I do, that's a tough question, basically.
Yeah, I think there's kind of two aspects to that question. It's not just, you know, is this something that could break through the logjam? But it also is, it seems to me, are you potentially making perfect the enemy of good? Like you said a second ago, that the Senate may pass sentencing reform, but it seems unlikely that the president would sign sentencing reform, given what we've heard so far during the administration, certainly what Jeff Sessions thinks. But and earlier we talked about this too, this notion that the people that would be helped might not be helped a large amount. And, you know, I mean, I totally get what you're saying, but what do you think someone who is about to go home because of this bill might say to that argument?
Yeah, I have a real hard time with that. Like, I guess my answer is that, you know, the main legislative proposal that we're backing is the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act, which has a non-trivial corrections component too. So, like, look, we're holding out for something that would give you very similar benefits, and that could be improved if we were allowed to consider moving that bill forward. But yeah, that's tough. Like, at the end of the day, they're actual people we're trying to help here. What it comes down to is I don't think this is as much of a help for those people as others say. And, you know, there are concerns that some of the other civil rights groups have raised too. Like, we've had several conversations with the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, and their concern is that the way that the recidivism reduction programming will be handed out in prison is in such a way that it could actually worsen racial disparities. And it would be handed out using a tool devised by Jeff Sessions and his buddies in the Justice Department, and that's not good.
So it's not an algorithmic tool, it's a risk assessment that they come up with?
It would be an adaptation of an existing risk assessment tool. But my sense is that there's enough discretion left up to the Attorney General in there that there could be harm done. And some of the amendments that came into this bill make that less likely, but they don't ameliorate that risk altogether. So that's one concern. And another, this is the one that really gets to me, is a lot of the provisions of the bill make it sound like the most successful types of recidivism reduction programming would go to people who are already low risk. And that seems like a defeat. That seems like it's defeating the purpose. Like, we know that people of all, quote, risk levels deserve some access to education and training. Programming to give them a better chance of successful reentry once they leave. And the bill doesn't seem designed in a way to deliver that. So it's not just that it's not sentencing reform, it's that it's not as successful as we'd like it to be even at stated goal.
Well, at some level, you're singing to the choir on that one. Probably my you know, the thing I complain about the most is carve-outs, and there seems like there's about 1,000 of them in this bill. It took me, you know, 20 minutes to read through and try to make sense of just the carve-outs. Do you have any sense, you know, of, you know, how many people would technically be helped even with the carve-outs?
So yeah, the carve-outs have changed significantly. Some iterations of the bill tried to make it made it simpler, saying like just a quote aggravated felony, people convicted of those offenses would be carved out. So the list of carve-outs got shorter, but the number of people covered by the carve-outs is probably the same. We haven't been able to do the math on exactly how many people would be carved out from it, but it's definitely non-trivial. There would be some, like, because of the way race in the criminal justice system works, there probably would be some disparate racial impact on that. And yeah, that's something to be concerned about too.
So one of the objections that I've heard and seems somewhat persuasive to me is that the bill didn't include kind of funding for programming and bed spaces, and there isn't enough programming or bed spaces currently available. I suspect that part of the suspicion around the bill is that for-profit enterprises would probably end up getting the contracts for that. I know we all have different opinions of that, but if there were alternatives that could be provided, would that still be an objection to the bill? Or
I think so. You've talked to my colleague LB about her views on private correctional corporations, I think. Is that right? Yes.
Yes, I have. Yeah, we did it. Yeah. Correct. On her book, yeah.
Inside private. So there are similar objections to be raised to, you know, private reentry facilities. There are some cases where private reentry facilities have turned into like debtors' prison gateways back to incarceration. Like you're charged a supervision fee for your participation in the rehabilitation center, and then if you can't pay that, and odds are you might not be able to, then you might wind up right back where you started from. So it's things like that that make me suspicious of, you know, turning that pretty important function over to private entities. The solution to that, LB would say, is structure the contracts in a way and structure the programs in a way to guarantee their success. And I don't think that type of guarantee exists currently. One thing that I was surprised by, actually, is there's been a lot of interest lately in repealing something that was created by the 1984 crime bill, which, among many, many other things, made incarcerated people ineligible for Pell Grants. Repealing that would be super simple. I've worked with the American Enterprise Institute on emphasizing the importance of education for people behind bars, you know, giving them a chance to learn if they want. And I was sort of surprised to see that simple repealer provision wasn't in this First Step Act. And I think that would have been just a way to get people excited. And it actually would have made a real difference for people too.
Yeah, it's very frustrating. The whole Pell Grant situation. I think one of the things I get really frustrated a lot is the combination of the inclusion of tablet technology into prisons, but only in a for-profit way and in a way that really doesn't provide exactly this kind of education.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm preaching to the choir on this too, but through that connection with the American Enterprise Institute, I've talked to people who really benefited from education behind bars, and it just strikes me as I was very frustrated to see that wasn't there. I think that's something that, you know, maybe could be changed during the amendment process, and that would make me marginally more excited, but still not sentencing reform, but it'd be interesting.
Right. Okay. And let's get to that sentencing reform question. Many of the opponents of this bill, I think, including you in this interview, have made the argument that in order to really reduce mass incarceration, we have to have reforms on both the front and the back end. But if people are continually released on the back end, wouldn't the effect on mass incarceration as a whole still be
pretty
positive?
But again, like this is not a bill that sees people ending their sentences early in any sense. So one thing we've been monitoring too, and this is sort of, yeah.
Well, hold on. Could you clarify that? Because if people get good time credits and that ends up shortening their sentence, you just said it doesn't shorten sentences. So I just want to make sure we're on the same page on this part.
Yeah. So what I'm talking about is if the credits are earned through the First Step Act, so that will let you start your pre-release custody slightly earlier. So those aren't credits against the end of your sentence. Your sentence is still being served, just not in a federal prison. That's just served somewhere else under home confinement. So I don't view that as a...
Sure. I don't mean to get too deep in the weeds, but like, for instance, in Michigan, we have, you know, when you're on parole and probation, you're considered still a prisoner. You're a level zero instead of a level 1, 2, 3, or 4. And so I don't know if that's always the case, but it's certainly the case here. Are you saying that's not the case in other places? Or
you're still considered under the custody of the Bureau of Prisons. So what I mean by reduced mass incarceration is end the sentence early. So if, for example, the First Step Act, rather than saying these are credits toward pre-release custody, if it were credits off your sentence entirely, I think it actually would be a different story. And I think the Brennan Center position might even be different. But that's not what it is.
Okay.
So that's one thing. And number two, something we've been watching somewhat closely is what is the real ebb and flow of prisoners in the Bureau of Prisons? You, as you know, the federal prison population has been trending down for a while. And that downward trend wasn't really changed in the first year of the Trump administration. We put out a report called Criminal Justice 1 Year into the Trump Administration that collected information on that very thing. But the rate of decline seems to be slowing. So query whether this attorney general and his insistence on seeking the most harsh punishment in every case, query whether that's starting to have an effect on how many people are going to prison and for how long. I think it'll take like another year at least for us to see whether the prison population is changing at all under Sessions. But his policies and the possibility that he might be having that impact of more people going to prison, reversing the years of decline we've seen, underscore to me the importance of front-end sentencing reform to, you know, rein in the attorney general and make sure that he can't pursue these draconian policies all over again.
Okay, well, as we've mentioned several times, the other people who are going to be on the podcast to talk about this are from Cut 50. Jessica Sloan is going to be my next guest, yeah. And she sent a question for you.
Yes.
And here's that question. Chuck Grassley himself has stated that no sentencing reform enacted is going to be retroactive. As such, what is your plan if First Step does not pass to help the people who are already living in our federal prisons?
Yeah, I mean, I saw that, and that's a really good question. So two things. Number one, we're not like our priority is sentencing reform, but all of the bills that we're supporting are bills that include a corrections component. The Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act would include a component that creates rehabilitation programs in federal prisons. So when we say pass sentencing reform, what we really mean is pass that bill. And that bill does include a component that helps people already in prison. So that's part of the answer. Number two is we recently put out a report that covers, you know, what we would like to see actually enacted by Congress. And one of them is the Dignity for Incarcerated Women Act. It was really cheering to see, as I think you noted in our pre-show conversation, like some of those provisions worked into the First Step Act.
I thought that was a really positive element of the bill, was that the Dignity for Incarcerated Women Act was included in, or at least elements of it were included in the First Step Act.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And I think that's a credit to Cut 50's advocacy. I don't think that would have been in there without them and people on the left pushing for it. So we still want to see that passed. We just want to see it passed as part of a broader package and could just be passed on its own. It's somewhat ridiculous. Like the more you think about it, that the basic provisions of that bill, one of which would make, you know, women's health products free for incarcerated women. It's shocking that that doesn't already exist. It's kind of galling to say, like, well, at least we're getting that. Like, that is such a basic reform and something that already should be achieved. Let's just have an up and down vote on that and make sure that that passes along with a package of other bills.
You may not believe this, but I've actually had conversations with U.S. senators who didn't even know that stuff wasn't already allowed.
Oh yeah, like I've learned so much about the basic indignities that women have to suffer during incarceration, not just from my colleagues here. You know, we partnered with Holly Harris at Justice Action Network, conservative group, to do an event about incarcerated women. And actually, our vice president for development, Jen Wise Wolf, recently put out a book called "Why Am I Blanking on the Title?" She's going to be very disappointed.
Well, if you tell me the title, I'll include it in the notes. So she'll get a
Periods Gone Public.
Oh, okay.
It's about menstrual equity, not just in prisons, but everywhere in society. So it sounds
logical to me.
Yeah, it does. So all this to say, like, we're definitely in favor of legislation like that. Just we want it to be part of a broader, more comprehensive package, or to see a commitment from legislators to, you know, not stop after the first step, but to be willing to take that second step and to tell us how they're going to do it.
Well, I feel, given your reference to the Caro book earlier, I would be remiss if I don't follow up with a question for how you see this happening. I understand that there's Senate support.
Yes. So I understand there's Senate support in some way. What I've heard is that Cornyn and Whitehouse, who were the backers of the Correction Act, have basically decided to adopt the to introduce and back a Senate version of the First Step Act. What I'm hoping will play out is I'm hoping we'll see some debate in the Judiciary Committee, you know, where Chuck Grassley led his committee to favorably report out a sentencing reform bill. I'm hoping we'll see Chuck Grassley, you know, push for some sentencing reform provisions to be included in First Step. And then, you know, we'll have to have a real, if that happens, like I could see the Brennan Center coming out in favor of legislation that was First Step Act plus some sentencing provision. I think that'd be really exciting. And I think it's something Chuck Grassley really passionately believes in. You know, we'll see.
So what we're looking for in your world, what we're looking for in your world is hopefully a need for a conference.
And some Senate. And some support from Senator Dick Durbin and Senator Chuck Grassley to push for sentencing reform to make it into the bill. And then I think we'll be having a very different conversation. I can't commit my organization, but but I think that'd be pretty exciting.
All right. So as we're wrapping up this interview, is there anything else you'd like to add about the bill or just in general?
So I think it's heartening to see some form of criminal justice reform coming up. Just what continues to disappoint me is I think this bill is just so much more conservative than the Senate as a whole would support on their own. And I think we really need to see especially progressive legislators stand up for what they believe in and say, you know, we believe in ending mass incarceration and this truly is a first step, but we need to see more. And I think Chuck Grassley's continued to fight against all odds for sentencing reform, and I really hope he continues to do that. But most of all, I hope that, you know, if this really is the best bill that Congress can get out, I really hope voters take note of that, and that voters, when they cast their ballots in the midterms and in the presidential, think very hard about what kind of legislators they want to send to DC and what kind of reforms those legislators should support when they're there. I don't think voters pay enough attention to criminal justice reform, don't pay enough attention to mass incarceration. So I think now's the time for them to start watching. And I hope they, you know, hold legislators to account if they can't do anything better.
Well, I certainly hope anyone who's a fan of my bars to ballots proposals who's listening heard that last part. So because one of my biggest things going into the next election is to try to get formerly incarcerated people to register and vote where they can and to vote only for their interests.
That is the Lord's work. That is really important work. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much for doing this, Ames. It was a real pleasure to have you as a guest.
Thank you for inviting me. I hope to be back sometime.
Thanks so much.
Thanks. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye. Okay, our second guest today is Jessica Jackson Sloan. Jessica is the National Director and co-founder of Cut 50, a national initiative pushing to reduce mass incarceration. Jessica is a human rights attorney who started out representing death row inmates in appeals and stays, and now she oversees the Dream Corps Cut 50 initiative. And recently, she's been incredibly busy working very hard with legislators to ensure the First Step Act will be the best bill capable of passing the House, the Senate, and ultimately receiving a presidential signature. So there's literally nobody better to discuss support for the First Step Act with, and I'm really happy that she's here. Welcome, Jessica. So nice to talk with you.
Thank you for having me on.
Not to get too far off track, but I think I left one part of your bio out. Am I right that you're also the mayor of Mill Valley?
Well, I served as mayor last year. I've been on the city council for almost 5 years now, and we take turns being mayor. So I got my turn last year, and this year I'm back to being just a council member, but still pushing for progress on important issues in our community, like affordable housing.
Awesome. I don't know where you find the time to do all the things that you do, but I'm impressed. All right. So here are the first question. I always start with the easy ones. I'm kidding, of course. I assume one of the most persuasive ads to the First Step Act that you all pushed pretty hard was when elements of the Dignity for Incarcerated Women Act were added to the bill. But can you also make Cut 50's full case for passage of the First Step Act in short?
Yeah, and I'll say, you know, there are some elements of the Dignity for Incarcerated Women's Act that are in this bill, but I think there's still a real need to pass the Dignity for Incarcerated Women's Act. There are a lot of provisions in there that were not put into the First Step Act, including getting male guards out of the bathrooms or medical areas where women might be in a state of undress, or they might be able to see women in a state of undress. This is a provision that we've been able to pass in several states at this point. And we really want to see passed on the federal level as well, so that we can really preserve women's dignity while they're incarcerated in the federal system. But overall, you know, for us, the First Step Act has been kind of a long journey. We came on board about 6 months ago when we started tuning in. At that time, it was called the Prison Reform and Redemption Act. And it was a piece of legislation that had some great intentions behind it, but it just didn't go far enough to be considered meaningful reform. At the time when we came to the table, we were supportive of the process of continuing to push for bipartisan support, even continuing to push just for prison reform, but we were not in support of the bill. So over the last few months, this bill has really improved, particularly in its last iteration, the version that was introduced. It fixes good time credits. It creates major incentives for participating in programming in the form of time earned credits. It creates and expands life-changing classes that people inside can take. It prioritizes people inside who need it the most to take those classes. It moves people closer to home. It does ban the shackling of women who are in labor and extends that protection for 3 months after their pregnancy, provides IDs to people, and it expands compassionate release. We've also got some provisions in there that hold the Bureau of Prisons accountable, which I think we can all agree is very important. So we're proud to now support this act and are hoping to see it pass.
So your organization's mission is to reduce mass incarceration by 50%, I think by 2030. But many organizations oppose the First Step Act because it only addresses the back end of mass incarceration. And they contend that just doing the back end really can't reduce mass incarceration. Why isn't reducing mandatory minimums and addressing some of the other sentencing reforms, for instance, in the Grassley legislation in the Senate, critical to meaningful criminal justice reform?
Well, let me start by saying I think this question assumes that we wouldn't think it was. Of course, we believe strongly in sentencing reform. I think it's critical that we get sentencing reform, or else the mass incarceration is going to continue. What the First Step Act does is it takes the first step. It recognizes the political realities that we are facing, and it takes the first step so that we can give people inside some of the relief that they need and some hope that they need. This bill will result in roughly 4,000 people being released with that good time credit fix. It also creates those time credits that allow people to go to halfway houses or home confinement sooner and not be stuck living in prisons. I've gotten out there and spoken to a bunch of the folks in our network who have family members who are in federal prisons or who have been in federal prisons. And resoundingly, every single one of them has said to us, listen, we get it. You are in a very difficult political situation, but please don't make the people inside wait to get some relief. Please pass something that can give them some hope, something to hold on to and start to improve conditions inside. I just don't think that, you know, we are in a position as people out here who are not living behind bars every day to tell people inside that they have to wait till 2021 or maybe even further when we have the political reality to get something done. So the First Step Act is the first step. We believe strongly in reducing mandatory minimums. We believe strongly in sentencing reform. But this represents a bill that we can get passed now that actually helps the people who are inside. And I'll take a second and say, with the sentencing reform, you know, even Grassley, who is a strong proponent of sentencing reform, has admitted that it's not going to be retroactive. So this bill right here is the only thing that can help people who are inside our federal prisons right now to create a path to come home sooner and provide them with some of the reliefs and dignities that they need.
As a formerly incarcerated person, obviously, to me, that's one of the most persuasive arguments is the notion that we need to bring home everyone we can bring home. One of the features of the First Step Act is that inmates would earn credits toward programming and bed space in halfway houses. Given that programming right now is underfunded, And there don't, at least the reporting I've seen suggests that there's not a lot of halfway house beds now. How do you think this will result in good outcomes for the people who receive relief?
Well, I think the halfway house issue is something that is incredibly real to us. I've gone out and visited some of these halfway houses. I think that the BOP needs to be held accountable. We need more halfway house beds. I think there are ways that we can begin to address this even outside of the First Step Act. I was honored to be invited to the FERC meeting, the Federal Interagency Reentry Council meeting at the White House a few weeks ago. And halfway houses and being able to expand the number of beds was actually one of the primary items discussed. There were several other people who had been incarcerated in the room who talked about how difficult it is to come home and not have a place to go or not have a place to live, or how they needed more time in a halfway house to really get ready to reenter fully. This bill, we worked hard to make sure that we were making the Bureau of Prisons accountable by changing a lot of the may language to shall, which will put a force on them to figure out how to get more halfway house beds. One idea that was tossed around at that FERC meeting was the fact that right now there are so many people who are in our halfway houses that don't actually need a bed. I've met folks who were sent to halfway houses after prison that could have just as easily gone to home confinement because they had a family, they had a house, they had a spouse that they could have gone and lived with, but instead they were sent to a halfway house. That needs to change immediately. We need to be using the halfway house beds for people who are reentering who don't have a home that they could go to, and instead putting people who do have a home they can go to on home confinement.
That's a really interesting point. So in that solution, you would actually not have to, the Bureau of Prisons wouldn't have to have more funding. It would actually probably free up funding in a sense from parole and probation. Am I right?
Well, I haven't crunched the numbers on how many people would be going home, but you know, because of the shall language, they're going to have to find solutions for this. And because of the funding that's in there, is authorized in there. You know, we can hope that more funding is coming for that. But I think, you know, changing a policy like that will make a big difference by freeing up some of the beds that people so desperately need to be going to that don't have a home that they can be confined in.
Okay. I think another concern that people have is there's a lot of, you know, I personally feel like all prisons, in a sense, are private prisons because they have certain incentives, profit incentives, for-profit incentives built into the system. But a lot of people, I think, are concerned that one of the ways that bed spaces and programming will be provided is through the for-profit prison industry. Is this a concern for you? I still think it's probably, we don't want to make perfect an enemy of the good. And if people get that out, that's good. But I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, first, let's start with, you know, zoom out a little bit. So the for-profit prison industry dilemma always kind of intrigues me because there are so many state prisons and so many companies that are making money off of people being incarcerated in state prisons as well.
Well, and I don't mean become for-profit partners in those, like from with Securus and JPay and companies like that.
So in regards to the programming, you know, we were able to get a very, very important piece into this bill that I don't think a lot of people are talking about and haven't realized. And that is the volunteer aspect. Currently, prisons that have volunteer programs and programs that are being run by nonprofits or for-profits tend to have much lower recidivism rates. Here at Cut 50, we've actually got a policy that we have to stay as connected as we can to this issue. And in order to honor that, we actually all volunteer in a music program in the prison nearby here, San Quentin Prison. It's probably my favorite time of the week, being able to go in there and work with the guys and see the progress they're making and talk to them and talk through the legislation we're working on. And I learned so much from them, and I learned so much and feel like it keeps me so grounded to be in there and working with folks. But San Quentin Prison, you know, I'm not the only volunteer in there. There's actually 13,000 volunteers that come in there every single year for the programming. And they're not only able to bring programming into the prison, that's not all of which is state funded. Much of it is not state funded. But they're also eyes and ears inside the prison. It really opens up the transparency to what's going on inside of the prison. And it provides men inside and in the federal system, men and women, it will be, with an element of mentorship, especially because this provision allows for formerly incarcerated people to come in and work with people who are currently incarcerated. So I can't think of a better system for programming than having formerly incarcerated people who have come out, successfully gotten through reentry, who understand on a personal level what sort of issues people coming out are going to be facing, and can really serve as mentors to the men and women inside. So I think, you know, there will be some for-profit prison, some for-profit companies who do programming, but there's also going to be a lot of nonprofits and a lot of volunteers who are able to come inside, do some programming, be the eyes and the ears, serve as mentors. Another piece that I think gives me some rest is, you know, the bill doesn't say that these grants need to go through the DOJ. Perhaps we can get them to go through the Department of Labor, and different organizations can go to the Department of Labor and apply for funding. So, you know, there are several different elements of this bill that I really think are going to be beneficial for the men and women inside, but the programming piece, to me, is the strongest.
That's really interesting. I know until last year, Michigan prevented any formerly incarcerated people from going into state prisons. I'm not as familiar with the federal system. We got some small changes to that made in the state. Are you saying that as a result of this bill, at least some formerly incarcerated people would be able to be mentors to people who are in prison at the federal level?
Yes. Yes, they'll be able to go in, and Cut 50 really can't take the credit for that. I know there was a lot of folks who were pushing for this, including Pat Nolan and others. You know, our own Topeka Sam has been pushing on this because they realize how important it is for people who've been formerly incarcerated to be allowed to go into the facilities and help people inside and bring that personal perspective in there.
Oh, yeah. I tell a story all the time about how I had a mentor that was set up with me, and both during prison and after prison, I wasn't allowed, as long as I was still on paper, to have any contact with them, which seemed totally ridiculous since they were, you know, doing really well on the outside and very well adjusted. So it is.
Yeah, there's no public safety rationale behind it, because nobody is going to be able to help people reenter as well as somebody who's already been through it and knows what obstacles are out there and how to overcome them.
So earlier you said that I think it was 4,000 people would be able to get out. I've read the bill, and it seems like one of my biggest pet peeves is carve outs. It seems like there's like 100 carve outs in this bill. When you talk about the 4,000 people, is that assuming all the carve outs?
That's regardless of the carve outs. And I want to say, if you look at the earlier drafts of this bill and you look where that exceptions piece was, who all was not going to benefit from this bill, you will see how incredibly far this bill has moved in terms of reducing the carve outs. Now, I'll say, somebody said it much better than I could, so I'm just going to quote Mr. Kushner here. When we went to the Problem Solvers Caucus, and Mr. Kushner and Van Jones, myself, several people from our team, including our own Michael Mendoza, who spent 2 decades in prison, starting when he was 15 years old, there was a lot of legislators in there who had some serious concerns about not restricting this to quote-unquote nonviolent offenders. And I'll just tell you, I hate that term.
Me too. Me too.
I think that this is a ridiculous wall that really has been built by people within the movement that should never have been built and that we need to tear down. But what was interesting is there was a lot of legislators who were raising their concerns around this. And I was kind of looking towards Mr. Kushner, wondering how he was going to address this, because at the time there was a horrible exclusions list that really excluded a whole lot of people. And I was wondering to myself, you know, is he going to stand up for the people inside, or is he going to cow down to these legislators and point to how many exclusions there are? And what he said actually surprised me. He looked at them and he said, listen, I want you to know, I don't care about the data that you guys are talking about, the nonviolent violent. He said, the only data I care about is not whether somebody was nonviolent or violent, but whether or not they're going to be coming home one day. Which I thought was pretty amazing.
I have to agree with you on that. That's music to my ears.
Absolutely. So are there carve outs in this? Yes. But after, you know, months of working on this exclusions list, we've been able to narrow it down to a pretty small percentage of the population. And, you know, even that I feel bad about. I feel bad if anybody is excluded from this. But politically speaking, we've gotten it to a place where 4,000 people immediately will be able to benefit from retroactive good time credit. And, you know, over 100,000 will be able to benefit from the time credits and all the other provisions in here. There's also provisions that everybody benefits from. So, you know, at the end of the day, I wish we didn't have to exclude anybody. And it pains my heart to know that we are. But I think we've gotten this bill as far as we can politically. And it would be unfair to those who will get out to stop it because it doesn't go all the way.
All right. Well, that's a great answer. I'm also, as you know, I already talked to Ames from the Brennan Center, and I asked him if he had a question for you. And this was his question. His question was, this is the first step. What's the next?
Well, I love that question because that means that Ames is on the same page as I am, which is our work's not finished here. If anything has been evident to me from this process, it is how much work we still, as a movement, have to do to create empathy in our legislators and in the general public. You know, just even this violent, nonviolent conversation around the exclusions list, that showed me, you know, how important it is to get some of the folks who have come home up there to Capitol Hill talking to our legislators. That day we went up to the Hill with Mr. Kushner, we brought Michael Mendoza with us. And Michael probably had the most poignant comments of anybody when he talked about having been incarcerated at 15 for a violent crime and what his transformation and journey to accountability and rehabilitation had been like and how legislative changes had inspired hope in him. And to see the faces on those legislators, to see the looks on those legislators' faces when he was telling his story, it was like they couldn't believe that, you know, he had ever been in prison. He presents in a suit. He's well-spoken. He's articulate, intelligent. And it was as though they were putting a whole different face to this issue than they ever had before. So the next step is that we need to continue to build empathy in our legislators and work together as a movement so that we can get to sentencing reform, so that we can make sure people aren't being excluded from other reforms, and so we can bring more people home.
Well, I mean, that's a great answer. And I definitely want to thank you for, especially when you told the story about going back every week to prison. I know for people like myself that just hearing that makes us all very happy. And so all the rest of the stuff that you're talking about, you know, a lot of it really touched me pretty deeply listening to. Is there any last things you want to say to people who are still uncertain about the First Step Act?
If you're uncertain about the First Step Act, we've got a website up, firststepact.org. You can go there. You can read some of the stories of people who would be impacted by this bill. You can sign a petition if you're so inclined, and you can read more about the legislation.
I know that if it's true Cut 50 fashion, you probably have a hashtag, yeah or no?
Hashtag First Step Act.
Okay. Figure I'd put that out there too. Thanks so much for taking the time to do this. I know you're super busy right now.
Thank you, Josh. I appreciate you having me on.
No problem. Thanks again. Bye.
Bye.
Our third guest is Jason Pye, who is the Vice President for Legislative Affairs at FreedomWorks and a supporter of the First Step Act. I came across Jason's writing recently as I was doing background research for this episode and was impressed with his perspective and evidence-based approach. I also wanted to include his voice because he was addressing some pushback against the bill from the right side of the spectrum that I had not heard before. I also should probably note that, like me, he's a lifelong baseball fan. Hello, Jason, and welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Josh.
You have to be thrilled with how the Braves have started off the season.
Hey, 10 games over 500, given where I thought we would be right now, I'm pretty happy.
Yeah, unfortunately, my Rangers are not doing very well.
But. Well, you got Bartolo Colon pitching for you. He's like, what? He's like 5 years older than God, and he's still throwing a fastball. So
yeah, and he's actually winning some games from whatever methods, you know, that remains to be seen how he's doing that.
Well, a lot of cheeseburgers and hot dogs and beer, I imagine.
So. Yeah, you know, big sexy and all that. All right, let's get to the questions. So,
all right.
There have been splits on the left between traditional criminal justice reform organizations, but after reading your article, it sounds like there's been some pushback from the right as well.
Yeah, it's kind of unfortunate because we view prison reform as really the lowest hanging fruit of what we can do on criminal justice reform, you know, taking out sentencing reform and overcriminalization and some other things, that this is really like the easiest thing. There's almost consensus agreement that recidivism reduction is important and we should do it. Unfortunately, a lot of the same voices who criticize like the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act in the Senate in the 114th Congress are back now criticizing the First Step Act, and they're citing a couple of different provisions. And the first one is the 500 driving mile rule, and the second one is the retroactivity of earned time credits under truth in sentencing laws. And they're framing it as a jailbreak. Of course, they frame CRCA, the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act, as a jailbreak. And it's really unfortunate because some of the things they're putting forward are entirely misleading, if not completely outright false. And it's just really frustrating for those of us who are center right or libertarian, because there's been, universal agreement, especially at the state level, that the approach that we're taking in First Step works. You have states like Georgia and Texas and South Carolina and many others who in Mississippi just adopted their second round of criminal justice reform just recently. And they've all recognized that this step works. And my governor Nathan Deal, has made this kind of a linchpin of his legislative agenda. It's going to be his legacy when he leaves office after two terms as governor of Georgia. It's just unusual to see or frustrating to see these people sort of say, no, we shouldn't do this. We should be locking up more people and, you know, recidivism reduction be damned. And we're just going to warehouse them with no real effort to rehabilitate them and get them ready for a life where they can be productive taxpaying citizens.
Yeah, it's pretty strange, given that over 90% of people come home, that would want people to come home in a situation where they're, you know, at more risk of reoffending than not, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
so
let me just add to that. And that's, I think you really hit the sweet spot there in terms of, you talk about more than 90%. It's actually, I mean, it's closer to 96% of people who enter into a prison cell are going to come out of that prison cell. And what we always tell our activist community, because we are first and foremost a grassroots activist community or organization. We have roughly 5 million activists across the country. And that's the question we pose to them is what state of mind do you want these people to be in? If they have addiction problems, do you want their addiction to be addressed? If they have a criminal record, do you want them to be able to find a job where they can contribute to society and don't have to rely on the drug trade? And that's really it. And that's the question. That's what we pose to people is, and there's this sort of misconception about why people get involved in the drug trade. And that was you mentioned the 500, the blog post you read of mine. There was a second blog post we wrote that we published the next day talking about some of this stuff and specifically focusing on why people get involved in drugs. And they get involved in the drug trade because they have, first and foremost, they have addiction problems. And that leads them down to a path of becoming a dealer and then eventually even doing more. And secondly, people who get involved in drugs lack economic opportunity. And these people come from impoverished areas in a lot of cases. And when they were, if they get a criminal record, their employment options become even less than what they were before. And when they get out of jail, they go back into the same routine. They go back to an impoverished area that where there isn't economic opportunity. Employers are skeptical of hiring them because they have a criminal record. So what we're trying to do is to clamp down on that or break the cycle of crime and occasionally violence that this will eventually lead to if we don't get a handle on it.
I really love that we can have these kind of conversations because it's really one of the areas where I've been able to reunite with my right-wing libertarian friends. We say a lot of the same things.
Yeah. So, I mean, the war on drugs has been a failure. I think people who don't realize that are ignoring the past 40 years and the $1 trillion we've spent and the lives that have been lost. Drugs are just as readily available as they were as they are. They're just as readily available now as they were 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 30 years ago.
One of my favorite things to say is, you know, since 1971, the war on drugs has never reduced supply. So
absolutely true.
So anyway, we could go off on that one for a long time. So let's go. So one of the points of the tension that you raised was about people objecting to the provisions in the First Step Act mandating that inmates would be located closer to their families and friends. Could you speak a bit about the 500-mile rule?
Yeah. So basically what the First Step Act states is that a prisoner has to be incarcerated within 500 driving miles of their family, of their primary residence, basically is what it says. So 500 driving miles is very different from linear miles because they'll put someone within 500 linear miles, but the driving miles is like 900 miles. So it's going to take a lot longer to get there. We're talking about almost 1,000 miles away. So in the evidence that we have, the best evidence that we have is that the closer an inmate is into to their family and they can see their loved ones and you know, develop that sort of like, look, I want to be home with them. I don't want to be here. It encourages them to lead a better life. And there was one guy from Idaho and his name escapes me. I source him in the blog post and I have the blog post here. I'm trying to find the quote. He says, anytime you move inmates away from the people who can support them, away from where they're going to actually reenter society, I have to say that it's flat out correctional malpractice. And it's Kevin Kempf of the Idaho Department of Correction who said that. And he's absolutely correct. You want these people to be close to their loved ones. And unfortunately, people are misleading it. And they're saying, well, we're going to wind up releasing – we're going to wind up putting someone like Dzhokhar Tsarnaev or Zacharias Moussaoui within 500 driving miles of their homes. And there are carve-outs both in the text of what the First Step Act says. It's in Section 401 of the bill as well as in current code. And in current code, it's 18 U.S.C. 3621B. There are qualifiers. It takes into account the nature and circumstances of the offense. And it also, if the court, the judge, the sentencing judge, recommends that they spend their time at a supermax facility or a maximum security facility, that's where they're going to spend their time. People who are citing this provision as a reason to incite opposition are flat out misleading people, if not flat out lying.
Am I crazy here? Or, for instance, the Tsarnaev, I mean, the odds of him compiling enough good time credit for it to be meaningful. Well, it's pretty small.
Well, I mean, guess. Yeah, it is. I mean, especially because he's been sentenced to life at multiple counts. He has multiple life sentences. You have Zacharias Moussaoui who has life sentences. And like in the case of Tsarnaev, yeah, he's going to be transferred, but he's going to be transferred to USP Terre Haute where we execute federal the prisoners who are on federal death row. Now, I'm not taking a position one way or the other on the death penalty, but that's where he's eventually going to lead up. He's not going to get earn time earn good time credit.
He's not going to be in a he's not going to be in a halfway house.
Right, exactly. Well, and also you have to look at the tech and the law. The First Step Act specifically excludes certain crimes from who committed certain crimes from getting good time credits. Now,
there's like 100 carve outs in the bill.
So, right, yeah. There are several. Right, and there's like 4 pages worth or 5 pages worth. So, people are making misleading statements about what the 500 driving mile rule does, as well as who someone like Tsarnaev is not going to get good time credits to go out of prison.
Right. Okay. So your article also discusses truth in sentencing. As you may know, in Michigan, where I live, we are one of the only states that still has real life truth in sentencing, so I'm pretty familiar with this. Can you talk about how truth in sentencing functions at the federal level and in this law?
Sure. So Section 102 of the bill, of the First Step Act, it amends another part of U.S. Code, and the part is 18 U.S.C. 3624B, basically to clarify congressional intent. Under current law, it says that a prisoner can earn 54 days of their term of imprisonment. The Bureau of Prisons has calculated that entirely differently. They have interpreted the language to require a prisoner serve 85% of their time, and it excludes the sentencing time taken off by good time credit. So it results in a maximum of 47 days per year of good time served. So and it's a misapplication of law. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court has upheld that interpretation. So this is a simple fix to current law. Which, and again, it says 54 days in statute. It's just the way BOP calculates it is wrong. It's a glitch. So it just fixes it. It addresses it, and it makes it retroactive to people who are already serving to fix the issue here with truth in sentencing law. And this is part of the 1994 crime bill. And it's again, just been misinterpreted and misapplied by BOP.
Gotcha. Okay, so finally, I mean, one of the biggest concerns with the bill seems to be that there's probably right now gaps in programming and shortages in halfway houses before the bill ever takes effect. Do you have any take on how this might be addressed?
Well, the First Step Act does require the Justice Department and BOP to utilize home confinement to the extent that they can, which home confinement is substantially cheaper. We're talking about ankle bracelets, ankle monitors that people have to wear. When they are released, they're given the opportunity to go to church, if they have a job, to go to that job, to search for a job, as well as to meet with their probation officer or who's dealing with them when they're in pre-release custody. So there are certain measures that are taken to ensure that they will be able to find gainful employment and comply with their release. But this is a positive step. We want more people placed in home confinement, mainly because it's cheaper, mainly because it provides a certain level of freedom to the prisoner to do things that normal people would do, like finding a job or working. So these are all things that we see as positive reforms. We would like to see less reliance on halfway houses because they are more expensive, because we have shortages. And frankly, I would prefer someone be sort of left alone rather than exposed to other people in a halfway house who may not be quite up to the same level of recidivism risk that this person is. Like if we have someone who's low risk and there's someone in the halfway house who is a medium risk, I wouldn't want them to be exposed together.
Okay, and what about the programming aspect?
Look, I mean, in terms of what we're doing here on programming, the in prison programming is going to be the same as largely when the person comes out, still trying to reduce recidivism, making sure they're complying with the terms of release. In terms of the in prison side, look, we've seen these in state prisons. There's a particular program in Texas where they come in and they teach inmates business skills. And I forget the name of the program off the top of my head, but the recidivism rate is 7%, which is extraordinarily low. We always say anything under 40 is okay. Once you start dropping below 30% recidivism, which is either the rearrest rate or reincarceration rate after 3 years, you're doing great work. And if you're down at 7%, that's phenomenal. So that's an example of a program we would like to see and would have the opportunity to have in Bureau of Prison System should the First Step Act be adopted. There are other ones.
Yeah, so one of the things that I always say is that we should treat prison like a hospital in the sense that we should start planning for return the moment somebody gets in.
Right.
And programming is certainly one way that that would happen.
Let me just Josh real fast. I mean, Pat Nolan often talks about like, if you have a hospital, the hospital comparison is just spot on. If you're sending people to a hospital and that hospital has a failure rate of 66% or 67%, which is the current recidivism rate in federal prisons, you would never send a patient to that hospital again. So we have to do something different here.
Yeah. So the other question was, what about the shortages in programming? How do you think that maybe Right now, we're having some shortages in the availability of programming. There's certainly a lot of great programming out there, but how do you think we might be able to address some of the shortages after, with new people coming out after the First Step Act?
Well, look, I mean, I think that the bill incentivizes a lot of companies to, or not com- well, companies, secondary schools, universities, colleges, nonprofits, including faith-based nonprofits, to do recidivism reduction programming. So it expands the opportunity by allowing more people to come in and do that programming. Whereas the current system, basically, it's there are inmates who run it from time to time. I've heard Kevin Ring from Families Against Mandatory Minimums, who served, I think, for 18 or 20 months at a federal correctional facility, talk about how the programming, both in and outside of prison, is not that great. This would provide a substantial improvement over current law.
Great. Well, I wish we could talk forever, probably. And it's really glad that I'm really glad that you came on such short notice.
Hey, thanks for having me, Josh. I appreciate it, man.
Yeah, hope to talk again.
Yeah, same here.
All right, bye bye.
Bye bye.
So, after three excellent interviews, where does that leave us? Today, several Democrats sent a letter encouraging their colleagues to oppose the First Step Act. I should preface this by mentioning that several of the signatories are people I greatly admire, including Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, and one of my heroes, John Lewis. Despite my deep affection and support for the signatories, I have to admit I disagree with many of their conclusions. Let's go through the main arguments in that letter. First, that the First Step Act excludes too many incarcerated people. This is a tough one for me. I hate carve-outs with a passion, and often find them counterproductive and based on little to no evidence. But the question should not just be, are people left behind, but also, are the people left behind in worse or better shape as a result of the legislation? Regardless of how many people go home, if the remainder are in no worse position, I am always going to be for sending folks home, or whatever is closer to home than being in prison. Maybe this is just a formerly incarcerated person thing. But having been in prison, I want as many people to come home as soon as they possibly can and in the best situation they can. I'm generally not a fan of home confinement, of monitoring, or other forms of community supervision, but I'm also for people being able to see their families, reconnect with their friends, and start working on a new life. I'm for people being able to go to the store, go to the church of their choice, and where possible, participate directly in the democratic process. These things most often cannot happen from inside a prison cell. I always say to people likely to go to prison that they should look at incarceration as a process of being moved into better and better boxes. You know, you start out in the worst box possible, and you keep moving to a better and better box. And even if that's not technically true, I tell people that they should think of it that way, because ultimately, at the end of the rainbow, you're out. Boxes outside of prison are better than boxes inside prison. And remember, I was on parole and probation for longer than some people, and my parole and probation was pretty restrictive, where I only got a certain amount of hours out per day. I think it was 5 during the week, and no hours out on the weekend. I still say being in my box outside of prison was better than being in my box in prison. Now, I will always fight to the death for the people left behind. That's why I think it's really important that this bill is called the First Step Act, which seems to explicitly acknowledge that there will be a second and a third and a fourth step, hopefully, and that we can continue to fight. Unlike many criminal justice reform bills, it doesn't make the argument that this is reform, and once it's done, all reform is over. Okay, the second argument they make is that risk assessments are inaccurate and racist. I've actually done a lot of research in this area, and I believe this argument is framed incorrectly. The question should not be, are risk assessments and algorithmic tools biased? Of course they are, because humans made them and humans are biased. The question should be, are risk assessments more or less biased than human beings left to their own devices? Right now, the alternative to algorithms or risk assessments is performance and disciplinary records. Those are assessed based on the whims of the Bureau of Prison employees. Now, I was at a state facility, not a federal facility, but I remember correctional officers at one of the facilities I was at openly supporting a basketball team I played for simply because we had more white guys on the team than the other team. I wish I was kidding, but that is actually true. I've had so many experiences, anecdotally for sure, with these kind of interactions with prison personnel. All of the research I've done, I don't know the research on the specific risk assessment tool being used here, but I have read a lot of research on risk assessment. And while it is biased, most of the evidence I've read suggests that it's less biased than human beings left to their own devices, which is exactly what happens in the status quo without this bill. The third argument they make is that the bill discriminates against immigrants. I absolutely oppose this element of the bill. I will fight for it to be changed. If the bill passes, I will fight for it to be changed in the second, third, and fourth step acts. The fourth argument they make, the First Step Act gives low and medium risk inmates first access to programming when high risk inmates are most in need of programming. Boy, I have experienced this myself at the state level, and I feel this one pretty deeply. I agree the bill gets this precisely backwards and should be changed. I do not think this is a reason to oppose the bill entirely unless relief is possible through a different vehicle. I do not see another vehicle passing in the status quo. However, I will fight for this to be changed, and if the bill passes, I will continue to fight for change in the second, third, and fourth step acts. The next argument they make is that there's not enough programming or space. Pretty sure I discussed this with all three guests. I think we should have more programming and more space, but I also believe we should not make perfect the enemy of good. The sixth argument they make is that there's inadequate funding for prison staff. Okay, I'm going to split this into two areas. For those who remain in prison, after the bill. Regardless of if there's a First Step Act, the prison budget was cut. In the world of the First Step Act, more people go home, or at least are in community supervision, which means less people remain in prison to be supervised or to be given programming in prison. You could even make the argument that this would make the resource crunch less acute as the result of passage. Okay, in addition, the bill creates alternative avenues beyond correctional officers and official prison employees to create programming, mentoring, and services. I suspect this, and not necessarily concern for prisoners' well-being, is why the Correctional Officers Union opposes the First Step Act. Okay, now for those who will be leaving prison, yes, more resources need to be dedicated to programming and bed space, but just like Jason Pye said, the preference in the bill is to opt for home confinement whenever possible, which is one way to free up bed spaces. I absolutely support increasing the resources for programming and housing for people released from prison, and always will. Is this enough for me to say that we should vote against the bill? Not in my opinion. The seventh argument. Attorney General Sessions cannot be trusted to administrate the First Step Act. I agree with this in principle, but there's one real problem with this. Jeff Sessions, Donald Trump, and Mark Inch are 100% in control of all inmates in the Federal Bureau of Prisons now. 100%. How in the world could the First Step Act make this worse? If they release anyone from custody, if they put anyone out of there, if anyone gets off of community supervision faster or gets into community supervision quicker, that takes them from total control to less control. Yes, they still administer these programs, but it has to be better than the status quo. Worst case, Mr. Sessions doesn't let as many people out as we would like or doesn't administer things as well as we would like, but it's still better than the status quo. It just doesn't seem like a good argument for opposing the bill to me. This is a zero-sum game. Now Sessions and Inch are 100% in charge, and nobody gets out. After the bill, people get out. Yes, we should absolutely be vigilant. Yes, I don't trust Jeff Sessions. Yes, this is problematic, but it is absolutely not a good argument for why the bill should be opposed. Finally, Jeff Sessions won't always be the Attorney General. Legislation is easier to pass than it is to repeal. What might be the possibilities of this bill with a pro-criminal justice reform attorney general? I suspect pretty good. Okay, the eighth argument they make, facilities will be privatized. I've said this before, and I will say it again. Prisons are all ready for profit enterprises, regardless if they have a corporate shingle or not a corporate shingle. They become more so every single day. They have for-profit partnerships where they get kickbacks from companies like Securus, who cut them in so that they won't fight back against usurious pricing and other kinds of terrible practices. This is not what you would call a unique complaint against this bill. Second, the question is not will private interests get more of a foothold, it is if they are being paid for better outcomes or just paid to provide programming alone. Obviously, what we're shooting for is them to start having to meet standards that ensure better outcomes. I don't think this is a reason to oppose the bill. I do definitely think it's a very important thing to watch for, and we should certainly insist that bidding is accepted based on outcomes for prisoners not just on the provision of programming, which is the way the status quo works and has been a problem for a really long time. The ninth argument. 4,000 people won't be helped immediately. Okay, I don't get why this is a reason to oppose the bill. If 500, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, or 4,000 people get to leave prison the day this bill is signed, that is good. That is not something to take lightly. I voted for President Obama twice, and I celebrated his commutations, but if I remember correctly, if you total up all of his commutations, it was a little over 1,000. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but I'm pretty sure it's right. And so if 2,000 or 3,000 people, which is, I suspect, given the way the letter is written, what would likely be the effect of the bill, get out because of the bill, why shouldn't we celebrate that any more than I celebrated the commutations? I'm always for people being released. The 10th argument, we have to address sentencing as well as reentry. First, in the letter, they say that prisons are full of nonviolent inmates who should not be in prisons as part of their argument for why we should address sentencing. I just want to point out that while this is true, as they mentioned above, the bill will make it easier for all low-level nonviolent inmates to get out more quickly, which means on its face, given their own arguments, they would reduce mass incarceration. Second, if more people are getting out on the back end, this means there is less churn and therefore less incarceration. And as John Pfaff has said, a lot of the people going into prison are on shorter terms, which means with less churn, you would have less mass incarceration. Third, we should be pushing for sentencing reform too. It will likely not pass or be signed by President Trump at the current moment, but we should always keep pushing for it. Finally, the sentencing bill in the Senate is flawed in several troubling ways, too. For example, it doesn't uniformly decrease mandatory minimums. It also increases mandatory minimums for some criminals while decreasing mandatory minimums for others. It is hard to take the arguments about carve-outs that were made above seriously, given the fact that they're pushing for a bill that actually increases mandatory minimums in certain areas. This shouldn't be a forced choice between these two things anyway. These should both be pushed at the same time. We should be trying to get as much reform as we can, and we certainly shouldn't stop one bill that has a lot of potentially great effects simply because it's not the same bill that someone else supports. There's also a really good chance that in order to pass this bill, that there will be other kind of poison pills put into it, like Tom Cotton's fentanyl exceptions or other brutal add-ons that could destroy or make the sentencing reform more harmful than good. I'm not saying I oppose sentencing reform. I'm saying there are some inconsistencies in the arguments being made in this letter against the First Step Act. Okay, now that was a long episode, but I hope it helped deepen your understanding of the First Step Act. I want to send a special thank you to all of my guests. I really am thankful for all of you, Jason, Jessica, and Ames, for coming on the show. I also want to send a special shout out to Andrew Stein, without whose help on the technical side, this episode would never have been possible. Make sure and listen to his podcast, Registry Matters, as well. It's also available on all the same places we are. Okay. As always, you can find the show notes at decarcerationnation.com. If you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so from patreon.com/onpiratesatellite. You can also support us by leaving a 5-star review from iTunes or Stitcher, or like us on Spotify. Thanks so much for listening to the Decarceration Nation podcast. See you next time.